there's a part of me that's feeling like I should apologise before even preaching this sermon, because I think it's a bit of a hodgepodge and I'm not very happy with it, but I do actually believe that preaching is sacramental and that God is capable of doing things with it that have no relationship at all to what I've done. And it has actually been my experience that the impact that my sermons have on people bears absolutely no relationship at all to whether I think that sermon was any good. So it is my prayer that this will be used of God. I think it was the theologian Carlyle Marnie who once said that, unlike us, God knows the difference between adjectives and nouns. We often make the mistake of using qualifying adjectives as nouns when we are talking of people. So instead of talking of a black person, we call them a black. Or instead of talking of a gay person, we say a gay. Or instead of talking of geeky people, we just call them geeks. And in the process, we can reduce people to a single attribute and make them less than human beings. We no longer see people as fully human. And when we do that, sometimes it's no longer obvious to us that we should be treating them with dignity and respect. We too easily forget that the other is a person created in the image of God. Perhaps even more damaging is when the labelled people begin to think of themselves only in terms of the labels that have been put on them by others. When people reduce themselves or accept the reduction of themselves to the embodiment of the label, it cripples and diminishes and limits them. There used to be a bloke in this congregation whose definition of himself was a no-hoper. Now, I'm betting that he wasn't the first person that used that description of him, put that label on him. But once he adopted it for himself, once he accepted it, it became increasingly true. Once he accepted it, it became self-fulfilling. He went about living down to it. The other thing about such labels is that they become boundary lines that keep us apart. Seems to be a deeply seated human characteristic that we are suspicious of those who are unlike us, and we choose to associate as much as possible only with our kind. And so people who are labelled as other are pushed aside and kept at arm's length. And the very process of labelling makes it easier for us to do this. If you are the one who is labelled as somehow being other, as an undesirable, if you've taken on those labels for yourself and so see yourself as inadequate, undesirable, unacceptable, then you probably find yourself in a very lonely place. Others don't want to seem to connect with you, and you don't see yourself as worth connecting with either. So you hide yourself away, cut off, isolated, lonely, hungering and thirsting for contact, but unable to cross the lines. The woman who Jesus met at Jacob's well in the Samaritan city of Sychar appears to have been just such a lonely, labelled woman. Even the time of the encounter tells us that. She is coming out for water at noon. Everyone else comes out for the day's water in the early morning, and it's quite a social event round the well. You only come out at noon if you want to avoid meeting anybody there. And when she unexpectedly runs into Jesus there and he proves to be talkative, we very quickly hear her come out with her list of labels, the reasons that she has come to accept that she is unacceptable, that she is an outcast. Firstly, she is a woman, and in that culture, women are second-class citizens and men do not talk to women. She is a Samaritan, and the Samaritans have been written off by the Jews as heretics and cut off from access to the temple in Jerusalem, and Jews do not talk to Samaritans. And she has had five failed marriages. The world said goodbye this week to someone who can beat that record. Elizabeth Taylor, I think, had eight marriages. I've sometimes heard people refer to her as an expert on marriage because she'd had eight of them. But, of course, we all recognise that that does not make her an expert on marriage. Possibly an expert on weddings, but certainly not on marriage. People who keep getting married and divorced are people who are unable to sustain intimate relationships. I say that as somebody who has been divorced. They may be skilled at attracting love, but they're unable to make it work for any length of time. I don't know if the woman at the well had half the beauty or glamour of Elizabeth Taylor, but they appear to be similarly lonely and desperate for affection and love, but unable to cope with it when it comes near. Elizabeth Taylor apparently said that she didn't like the way she looked, she didn't like the way she spoke, and she didn't like the way she acted. She didn't really like anything about herself terribly much. And when you don't like anything about yourself, you'll probably reject and push away anyone who does seem to like any of those things about you. The woman at the well appears to have been a very lonely woman, labelled and shunned by the people of her town, sneaking around and trying to avoid everyone, and labelling herself with the same dismissive labels that other people have put on her. There's a metaphor used in the reading for this desperate loneliness. It's the image of being parched and desperately thirsty, a craving thirst for acceptance and intimacy. We heard the image in the first reading too, when the people of Israel cry out for water in the desert. And the metaphor is developed by Jesus with his contrast between water that only fleetingly satisfies and living water that quenches our deepest thirsts and satisfies forever. Many of the things for which lonely people grasp to try and quench their thirst are things which provide very little satisfaction. And of course, there are whole industries built up around keeping it that way. Because if you can offer the promise of satisfaction in a way that looks convincing, but which will leave the thirst craving for more, then you can keep selling the same product over and over again. If you sell something that lastingly satisfies, it's not actually that good for business. The gambling industry is probably an obvious example. And perhaps more closely related to the thirst for intimacy is the pornography industry. It is one of the biggest money spinners on the planet, and its whole mode of operation is to turn the visual appearance of intimacy into a saleable product, which will keep people coming back for more, still unsatisfied. And pornography does that by feeding people images that undermine their ability to enjoy real, meaningful sexual relationships. We have a whole generation of young people, young men in particular, whose ability to enter and enjoy proper sexually intimate relationships is being deliberately and systematically destroyed by an industry that is making massive profits out of keeping them lonely and unsatisfied and with an unquenchable raging thirst. It's kind of like an industry comes along and conceals the source of fresh living water and sells us slightly salted bottled water instead to keep us getting thirstier and more desperate. The way Jesus behaved with the woman at the well was a shock to everyone. The woman expresses her surprise. The disciples express their shock. And the people of the town were no doubt initially scandalized as well. Jesus is breaking all the rules and crossing all the boundaries. He's treating this woman as an equal, as someone worth talking to and worth relating to. when all the social expectations that the rest of them abide by say that she should be kept where she belongs. She should stay in her place, out on the margins, in the shadows, out of polite company. She's a scandal and a disgrace, and she should be treated accordingly. But Jesus doesn't care less about such niceties. He doesn't see a scandal and a disgrace, but a person created in the image of God and desperately in need of the living water of love and mercy and grace and intimate communion. The townspeople no doubt think that she should mend her ways and clean up her act and repair her reputation before they would be considering rethinking their attitude to her. But that's not Jesus' way. The Apostle Paul put it very clearly in our other reading. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. While we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his Son. God does not demand that we make the first move, that we earn an offer of renewed relationship. God takes the initiative and simply offers it to us. A gift of living water offered to us while we were still treating God as an enemy. Without that gift, we will stay locked behind our labels, unable to take the risks that intimacy and friendship require. But God comes to us in Jesus and finds us where we are hiding and simply offers the gift of himself. And through the gift of himself, the gift of a new family, a new community, a new network of relationships that are not based on the old labels, but on our common identity as those who have found forgiveness and new life in the living water of Christ's love. Shortly we will be gathered again around this table where Christ offers himself to us in bread and wine and water. This story that we've heard comes from John's Gospel, which is the same one that provides the images that the church has used in using both wine and water at the table. Jesus offers himself as the source of living water bubbling up within us. And when he hangs on the cross, in John's Gospel, a soldier stabs him in the side with a spear, and John says that water and blood poured from the wound. It is here at this table that Jesus continues to offer himself to us as living water, as the true drink that can quench our thirst so that we will never cry out in thirst again. And it is here that Jesus invites us into the communion of his own love and of the fledgling love of his stumbling community, so that we might find ourselves beloved and set free to be the people we were created to be. Living water, pouring forth for the healing of every individual and for the healing of the world. Amen.